Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. That very beautiful Dhamma talk request made me think of the qualities of the Dhamma. Beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. Sila is beautiful in the beginning, samadhi is beautiful in the middle, panya, beautiful in the end. Dhamma practice, something which is wonderful, magnificent, through and through, for one who practices it. Got about 5 weeks left of the winter retreat. Coming into springtime. And what's really important is not what sort of states we're getting. That's not so important. What's important is, are we learning something? When the retreat ends, or will we be able to take this learning from the retreat and apply it to our lives outside of retreat? Or we may have some sort of really magnificent, blissful state. The retreat ends, that state ends, and then have we learned anything from it, or just go back to how we were before. Or we might be going through some sort of storm, but we might learn a lot from it. We might be suffering a lot, but we also learn a lot. Then we can apply that outside of retreat. And then outside of retreat becomes the same as being in retreat, being in retreat becomes the same as being outside of retreat, and there's no difference. It's like Ajahn Suchitto, like somebody's asking him, when's the winter retreat going to start? And he responds saying, for some it's already started, for some it never will. So so retreat is a state of mind. Incredibly helpful to have the daily teachings, incredibly helpful to have the structure. Or right now, complete lack of structure. Incredibly helpful to have that open time for practice and development in more of a focused and formal way, formal sitting, walking meditation, study, nourishing the roots of the practice. It's also good to see, what can I sustain, what can I develop that is sustainable all year round, all year long, learning. There's an interesting set of dhammas, the Vesaracchakaraṇa dhammas, these five dhammas which give courage. Reflecting and contemplating these, this is faith, virtue, learning, energetic striving or effort, and wisdom. And these are five dhammas which, when one cultivates them, one is able to overcome a sense of being timid in the practice, and one is able to develop a sense of courage and a sense of commitment to the practice. So faith, saddha, this word also implies courage in the Pali, saddha. And this one's fairly easy to understand if we understand it in terms of the five faculties: saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. So virya, if we're putting forth effort in something, for example, the meditation, we already have a measure of faith that it's going to be useful. Anything we put effort into, we can be sure that we have saddha in that thing, we have faith in that thing which we're doing, which we think is going to bring benefit to us. And sometimes it can be misdirected. We can have faith that something is going to bring us benefit and it actually doesn't. It actually brings harm to ourselves or harm to others or harm to both. But we have saddha, which is influenced by panya, saddha, which is influenced by wisdom and informed by wisdom. And that's what's going to lead us to want to put the effort into the meditation, effort into sitting and walking meditation, effort into study, both external study and internal study. And saddha is also a lot of, I've heard a lot of senior monks say saddha is that which actually lets go. So learning and also panya, which comes from the internal learning. But these things can bring us to the edge, but saddha is what causes the actual act of letting go. So you might think of it as learning can bring you to the edge of the cliff, and saddha is that which jumps. Because you're going into something which is unknown, which hasn't happened before. In a sense, the learning and the wisdom that we develop, it's safe because it's something we can choose to look at or not, or it's something that we're developing at our own pace. But then when we jump off the cliff, we don't know what's going to happen. And when we jump into the stream of the Dhamma, we don't know what that's going to be like. We've just been in the stream of the world, never experienced the Dhamma, so and then there's, after saddha, sila, virtue, precepts, discipline. Sila, yeah, on the external level is 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 227 precepts, 311 precepts, or many more contained in the scriptures in the Chulavaga, many, many more. I think somebody counted over 2,000 or something. Protocols, etiquettes, minor trainings that we follow. Then there's the internal sila, which comes from sati, and the internal sila. We call it Indriya Sangvara Sila, which refers to the sense restraint. And that refers to what is coming in through our eyes, what's coming in through our ears, what's coming in through the nose, coming in through the tongue, coming in through the tactile sensations of the body, and coming in through the mind, through ideas, the 6 sense bases. And the way we relate to and regulate those 6 sense bases refers to the internal sila. So it's the way we direct our eyes, the way we direct our ears, and so on. And this isn't contained in the external precepts so much per se. There are some training precepts, the sakyas, like one is to, a bhikkhu is to keep one's, their eyes downcast while in inhabited areas, for example, so you there is a little bit of regulation on that level, but mostly it's an internal sila, what we choose to look at, what we choose to listen to. How we choose to proliferate, use our ideas. Sila as discipline is also, it's the putting effort into the sense of deportment. As thinking during the meditation, it's the bowl washing area has been impressive these days. It's been this way for a while. Not much talking, if any, during bowl washing, and that's something that Lungpo Cha praised and told the monks to not talk during bowl washing. And this is one of the few monasteries where I've actually seen it happen. Wat Bopong itself is still quite good. When I was living there anyway. But then there's always a balance with the sila, both the external and the internal sila. There's always a balance. There might be a desire or a impulse to quickly point things out to other people if you see them transgressing some minor rule or doing something wrong. There might be a quick impulse or a reaction to want to point that out to them, but also this, we have to be very forgiving with each other. I've been listening to a number of talks in Thai by Lungpo Ban, very senior, highly regarded monk in Thailand, the abbot of Wat Doi Dhammachedi. And even though he's normally very uncompromising in the talks, talking about the cultivation of sati and samadhi, panya, and sila, still a thread through that is this incredible kindness. I was listening to this talk the other day, and he's saying, you all have to be extremely forgiving with each other, incredibly forgiving with each other. You can't expect one another to be arhants. You can't expect everybody to just be an arhant. So we're all in the world, we're all in the same boat. And so before pointing out something to someone else, we really have to consider all these, bring these considerations to mind. Are we free of that fault ourselves? Or are we doing it out of kindness or out of anger? If we're doing it out of anger, it's not helpful, not beautiful. Remember the being impressed with the bowl washing area at Wat Bopong, and was going to wash my bowl one day, and there was another Western monk there, and I don't think he could read Thai, but he was washing his bowl in the spot that's normally reserved for Lungpo Liam's bowl. So normally, like for a Thai monk, it would be unheard of that somebody would actually wash their own bowl in that special spot. And there was a sign in Thai saying, reserved for Lungpo. And so I said, very quietly, very kindly, not out of anger, oh, could you wash your bowl over there? You're washing your bowl in Lungpo Liam's spot. And then, without breaking into speech, he pointed at the sign that said, no talking in the bowl washing area. So that's called imbalance of seal. Okay, so you have to know time and place. And then, of course, I was angry, which also isn't helpful. So the dance of trying to follow the Dhamma Vinaya internally. A sila, giving external and internal sila, giving a sense of courage. There's also a really strong sense of almost like a sense of pride that comes when one reflects on one's actions and one realizes that they're in line with Dhamma Vinaya. A sense of wholesome pride, sense of accomplishment. When maybe in the past one wasn't restrained by way of the sense faculties, but then through effort one then in the present comes into the restraint of the sense faculties. There's a sense of wholesome pride that, yeah, there's been development. In the past, this wasn't there. In the present, it's come to be. That sense of restraint gives a sense of pride, a sense of courage, a sense of confidence. Then we have Bahu Satcha, great learning. It's the Dhamma that gives courage, overcomes timidity. There's the external and the internal learning. So the external learning, you know, incredibly important. Of course, learning the sila, learning the discipline, memorizing the Padimokkha, the suttas, memorizing suttas, Lungpa was reading the Chanki Sutta the other day, and that sense of memorizing Dhamma is a factor for internalizing and coming to a reflective acceptance of the Dhamma. So memorizing the text, the verses, the 84,000 baskets of Dhamma. Don't have to memorize all those, but good to have a wide range of learning. Like Master Xuanhua would say, when you first come to the practice, burn through the sutras, burn through the teachings. You know, read as much as you can, get a well-grounded, well-rounded understanding. At least have a basic knowledge. Dhamma Vinaya. Then there's the internal education, the internal sense of learning. It's cultivating mindfulness. Mindfulness runs as a thread through all of this. Mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness coursing through the whole body from the head down to the feet, back up to the head, knowing the body inside and out. And the internal learning is what types of delusion, what types of attachments, what types of aversions, where are they experienced in the body and where are they experienced in the mind. And we'll need very bright sati, very bright mindfulness to notice these and see these, to illuminate all of those dark spots in the mind and the heart. Viryarambha is effort, striving. It's the fourth thing that gives rise to courage and overcomes timidity. Viryarambha. And so a sense of patient endurance, a sense of putting forth effort, a sense of striving. This is also a thread which runs through the Dhamma teachings constantly. A sense of effort or ardency, a sense of urgency, a sense of striving. Yeah, seeing where there might be laziness or just wanting to coast or take it easy. Like for people who are ordained, it's helpful to reflect, like, my very life is sustained through the gifts of others. So am I putting forth effort? I was going up to my kuti after the meal, feeling drowsy, wanting to lie down, wanting to take it easy, and reflecting that my mom is a nurse, and she can't just lie down in the middle of the day, and, you know, while working. So I'm a younger person should be able to at least put forth enough effort to be awake after the mealtime. So using reflections like that to cajole oneself and to convince oneself to put forth effort. Reflecting on Dhamma, reciting Dhamma, there's all sorts of skillful means we can use to bring up a sense of striving. The Wanpra, we follow once a week. Here at Abhayagiri, this is the day of striving. We stay up most of the night meditating, so it keeps that sense of striving alive. Keeps the practice alive. It takes effort to keep the practice alive. I think it's in the book Venerable Father, Paul Breiter, he asked Lungpo Cha, like, how long could somebody stop practicing and still be kind of okay? Or how long? It's kind of a funny question. And actually, Lungpo Cha, he sort of thought about it, and he said, 15 days. Longer than that, it's going to be really hard to get it back. So he gave a very realistic answer. That's what's so helpful being in the monastery. The Wanpra, once a week. So even if we lose the plot, we have this group practice. Even if we completely lose ourselves during the open period right now when there's not much structure, still there's the daily teachings, still there's the Saturday night, still there's the all-night vigil in the Wanpra. The open period, like we have right now, is incredibly helpful for a sense of discipline as well, a sense of putting forth effort, because one gets to see, it's also helpful for that sense of internal study, because one gets to see how much is one dependent on the form, how much is one dependent on the morning and evening pujas and the group meditations for putting forth effort. Does one put forth the same amount of effort or even more in the kuti? Some people put forth more, and some people, like myself, put forth a lot less. You know, some people who are well-developed, have a sense of internal discipline already, they put forth even more effort when they're completely left to their own accord in their kuti. But it's really good to see, it's very helpful to see that. I know when I first came here to the monastery, I had romantic ideas about solitude and living in caves or being a hermit or a yogi. And I actually tried that before coming to the monastery. I tried living in the forest, in a very remote section of forest. I was going to live there for a week, just doing sitting and walking meditation. And once I hiked out to this very remote area, I realized I actually had no idea how to meditate. Had never really asked anybody or read about how to meditate. I just had this romantic idea about that I'm going to be a hermit, yogi, meditation master, even though I had no idea. No sila, no learning, no panya. And after one day, in this forest where there's like really, really remote forest in Big Sur. Had my dad drop me off at this place and hiked way out where there's almost no trail, way out in this tract of land where nobody goes, and there's mountain lions. And I don't know if anybody here knows what a fox sounds like, but there's like all these foxes around. And I went to sleep that first night and just had a sleeping bag, and there was like animals running over the sleeping bag and like lots of foxes making noises all around, and it was quite frightening. And so didn't sleep very well. Finally morning came around and I was really happy to still be alive. I didn't get eaten by a mountain lion or anything, and hiked out of there really fast and sort of like no way, this is way too difficult. And of course then coming here and realizing, okay, there's this whole path of practice and study and training. This is what I was attempting to do. Was like, it's like going to your first piano lesson and then hoping you can play sort of the most difficult Beethoven or Mozart or whatever after your first piano lesson. And it's takes training and diligence and effort and study, contemplation, practice. But I remember during my first Vasa as a bhikkhu, during the we have these 2-week solitary retreats in the summer period, and I decided to do this 10-day fast, master cleanser fast with the maple syrup and lemon juice, and really putting a lot of effort into the sitting and walking meditation and being having some success at that kind of putting forth effort in solitude. And then remembering, during that retreat, remembering back to the time when going into the forest and felt really happy with myself that I was sort of really doing what I wanted to do, attempted to do before. So up at the, staying up at the gypsy caravan up there in the forest. And then later on, getting to go to Thailand for my third Vasa, and after that third Vasa, getting to live at Phujomgom for 2 months, and going up and living in a cave there, and then sitting in that cave and thinking, this is just so amazing, just living in this cave. It's just like a remembering back, having a dream of being a cave yogi, but then, of course, after that, thinking, "Oh, that's ridiculous." But then, being in that cave at Phujomgom, thinking, "Wow, you know, I'm actually living in a cave. This is amazing. Actual being a cave yogi." So that sense of putting forth effort is something which takes practice, takes time. It has to be balanced too. Like we might hear these teachings like eat little, sleep little, speak little. These are the three dhammas that are never wrong. They're taught by many, if not all, of the Kruba Ajahns, the Thai forest Ajahns. So as Westerners with minds which tend towards extremes, we think, oh, eat little, sleep little, speak little. So if I don't eat at all, and if I don't sleep at all, if I don't speak at all, that'll be even better. And Ajahn Chah, he would see this, and he just kind of... There's one teaching where he's like, yeah, if you want to become a shriveled up wraith, you know, go ahead. It's not going to be very helpful, but you might as well try it and see that it's not helpful, and then you know. It's so hard to be balanced. It's so ordinary. It's not fantastic. It's not amazing. It's so ordinary. It's nothing to write home about. Just eating a little, speaking a little, sleeping a little. Then the fifth Dhamma is Panya, wisdom, which also comes from mindfulness and samadhi, mental collectedness, one-pointedness. And I really love the way Lumbur Ban was describing Panya in this one talk, is that it's thinking of sati as this incredible radiance which is coursing through your body, and then directing that radiance into the mind, and that when that radiance is directed to some point, nothing can be hidden from that radiance. So everything is seen with sati. And then the radiance is directed to some point, and then when something which wasn't seen before is seen, then that's panya, when we see clearly. That's the arising of panya, thinking, oh, there's something there I haven't seen before. There's something there which either I need to deal with, or it's a virtue that's there, or it's something which is there which I can learn from. That's panya arising. Or there's some way which we were relating to, say, our own body, which was coming from delusion. Say, for example, thinking that one's own skin is something beautiful, and then you have mindfulness directed towards the body and you investigate it. Say, for example, like you don't bathe for 1 or 2 days, then the skin is something which is unclean and starts to stink. And so then panya arises, delusion that was there before is dispelled when that radiance of mindfulness is directed towards that delusion. It's dispelled. Or the delusion that eating more is going to be better. So we have a lot of food in the bowl, and then a lot of good food. We eat gourmet meals here every day, and a lot of good food in the bowl. So one is already full, but then it's so good. It's going to be better to eat more rather than stop. And I don't know, every time I've done that, hasn't had much benefit afterwards, but it can take years to notice that delusion which is saying, take more. Finally, that delusion is seen, it's dispelled with panya. It's thinking of the drawback, thinking of what's the result of this going to be. It's seeing that there's gratification in things, that seeing that there's danger in things, that seeing there's an escape from things. And the gratification is, it actually is gratifying, it actually is pleasurable, it actually is liked. The drawback or the danger is, it actually is going to bring suffering afterwards, it's actually going to bring discontent afterwards. Escape, complete abandonment of that craving and that delusion, which is saying, you know, take more, take this, take delight in this, take delight in that. It's like, tatra tatra abhinandini seyatidang kama tanha bhavatanha vibhavatanha. It's like ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there, in sensual desire, desire for becoming, desire for annihilation, tanha. So we have to contemplate, we have to using panya to see tanha more clearly. Even the Lord Buddha saying tanha wasn't dispelled for him until he really saw very clearly the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of tanha. I think coming back to effort a little bit, something more could be said there. Just thinking of the Buddha himself, just putting forth the most extraordinary effort for the sake of us, for the sake of future generations, for the sake of all beings. And really what we're trying to do with our own practice is realize that same Dhamma which the Buddha realized. And the Buddha, with all of his paramis and cultivation, even for him it was difficult. And so effort is so important. And it's not going to be, even though we have the Dhamma teaching, we have the external teachings, and we have the suttas, still it's not going to happen just automatically. I think it takes real samma, has to be samma, a real balance of effort, a balance of spiritual qualities. The Buddha made the breakthrough only with great striving, otherworldly striving. And he said that we don't have to do that, but still it's worth reflecting upon that anyone who comes to realize the Dhamma realizes the same Dhamma that the Buddha realized through that great striving. And that this is something which is supreme, which is the highest and foremost. If we chant that in the meal blessing sometimes, agata we pasana nang. Aga is like the foremost. And I previously didn't know the translation of that chant, and then one of the Dhamma teachings in the mornings, I think it was Lungpa, read out the translation of that particular chant. And then we did that chant at the meal, and my hair was standing on end during the meal blessing then because of knowing the meaning of it. The Dhamma, the Buddha is the foremost, the Dhamma is the foremost, the Sangha is the foremost. Just imagine, just think how much effort we put forth into making money. Everybody in the world, most people in the world, putting forth incredible effort to make money. Just working one's whole life to make money, to make a living. Yet with the sila and the Dhamma, it's like a Lungpa Cha saying, if you were to say, crush this ant and I'll give you $1,000,000, I wouldn't be able to do it. Just kill that ant. Who here would, if somebody came up to you and say, crush that ant and I'll give you $1,000,000, what would you give more importance to? The sila or the money? So it's a paradigm shift. It's giving importance to the Dhamma, the Vinaya. We might feel bad if we don't have that much money. But in the long run, in our life, it's much worse to not have Dhamma, to not have sila. To not have sati is much worse than not having money. And then the Dhamma it's worth more than anything that money could buy. It's what brings joy, brings contentment, brings peace, brings nibbana. The Dhamma of the Lord Buddha. And yeah, we've come here to cultivate the Dhamma. This is amazing. So sometimes when there's open schedule, I like to also read a biography of a meditation master, or augment that open practice with some sort of reading. So it's reading the biography of Dogo Khyentse Rinpoche, being very inspired by his life. And there's one part in there where he talks about three dhammas, which are very helpful, which kind of resonates with those Vesa Rajakarana dhammas, the dhammas which give courage. But he calls it the three dhammas which are characteristics of a noble being, and that's learning, discipline, and kindness. And I thought that was interesting because the learning, again, it's having great external learning, but also great internal learning, internal investigation. And the discipline is the sila as well. But the discipline is also deportment and having integrity and living an upright life. Ujjupatipanno, as we've practiced directly. So integrity, honesty, being very, very open, and kindness. Yeah, just remembering the kindness of different great beings like Lungpo Cha, just to supreme, like Lungpo Cha's supreme kindness to put forth the utmost effort just to pass on his heritage, the Dhamma, to future generations. Just the incredible kindness, the incredible sense of effort and compassion there. It's worth reflecting on. Or when His Holiness the Dalai Lama is asked, how would he define Buddhism? He would just say kindness. He would just say, kindness is my religion. Kindness to oneself, kindness to others. A lot of time it's easy to be kind to others, but not so easy to be kind to oneself. Sometimes easy to be kind to others, easy to criticize oneself. So kindness to oneself. And that's practicing Dhamma. That's a kindness to oneself. Bringing in the wealth of the Dhamma, building up the wealth of the Dhamma, attaining the wealth of the Dhamma, being rich in Dhamma, being rich in sati. The Dhamma is something which is rich and beautiful. It's not at all barren or remote or lonely. Certainly not suffering. So it's something to think about. The Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle and the end. Sila is beautiful in the beginning. Samadhi is beautiful in the middle. Panya, beautiful in the end. Yeah, learning, discipline, kindness. So, a few things to reflect on this evening.